particularly dry mountaintops, made an enormous difference. There are two other things. Another is how clever you are at building widgets. And you will see some very clever widgets over the next, I don't know, what time should I stop? 10 after, something like that? Yeah, okay. Some very clever widgets over the next 20 minutes or so. and the third is the community of users. And there have been times, at least in the history of astronomy, where that was the single most important issue. You notice there a very early astronomical observatory that shows fastening the thing down is sometimes a good choice. Now, on the other hand, for a millennium, this was the state of the art in observational astronomy. It is, of course, an astrolabe. It dates from, I forgot to put the date on. It dates from 1030 or thereabouts. It was manufactured for use somewhere around Valencia, Spain. And it's partly broken, but it is the oldest one surviving. It's in the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. And Dave Javorkin kindly provided this picture. It's probably not visible from there, but if you get up close, you discover that some of the writing on the surface is, as you would expect, Arabic, and some of it is Hebrew. How was an astrolabe used? Well, here's a much later one, and there's a guy using it. That also gives you some feel for the scale of the thing. It wasn't the size of a pocket watch, but it also wasn't the size of the wall of the room. It was the size of a dinner plate. And there is a chap using an astrolabe to measure an angle in the sky, which is basically what these things were for. And the next major, major step, and I've called it Precambrian here, but it shouldn't be, that's one of Tycho's telescopes. It's close to an astrolabe, but fastened to the wall. And things like Tycho's device, astrolabe-ish, but fastened to the wall, and eventually with a telescope, put along that diagonal member, no, I don't want a pointer, so that you could measure angles more accurately. That was the state of the art for positional astronomy down almost to modern times. There were mural quadrants of this type in use at the Greenwich Observatory right down to the 1950s. They finally retired the Halley mural quadrant somewhere around 1950. So fastening it down was a major step forward. And then, of course, you've settled your location for the foreseeable future. Telescopes of this type were what Bradley used to demonstrate that the Earth goes around the sun, not parallax, but aberration of starlight. And there is Bradley. And there is one of those mural quadrants. That's what Galileo used to discover Neptune, and Piazzi used to discover the first asteroid. And astronomy in those days meant measuring positions, and it was done with refractors. And refractors for positional measurement was the state of the art for centuries beyond that, that you could do astrometry, accurate positions, parallaxes, proper motions with reflecting telescopes is such a recent discovery. I'm about to put myself in a knot. My own thesis work was a relatively early demonstration that you can do positional astronomy well with reflecting telescopes, positions of measure the expansion of the Crab Nebula. Okay, but notice again an instrument very much like Tycho's from before 1600. This is the one that was retired in 1950. This is the RGO, Bradley's quadrant. The first telescope looked kind of like that. Notice that it wasn't pinned down because Galileo took an interest in things besides positions. He wanted to see detail in astronomical objects. Notice also that he's already stopped down the lens to reduce chromatic and other aberrations. And here is a standard picture of Galileo and a slightly later one of his telescopes. Notice that like the astrolabe, a Galilean telescope was something of an art object, made for patrons. Astronomers have always been dependent on sources of money. And we now think of PPARC or the NSF or whatever happens in whatever country you come from. In those days, it was mostly patrons. Somewhat similar in music, of course, and William Herschel did both. And when he did music, he was the chapel organist in Bath. When he did astronomy, he worked for the king. And for a brief period, he tried to do both, and this was a difficult pair to please. But quite often, early telescopes were art objects. What is this? Oh, this is a sort of prototype of the kind of telescope with which parallax was actually discovered. Refracting telescopes, mirror diameters of order 8 or 9 inches. Struve used one, Bessel used one, Henderson at the Cape, whom nobody has heard of, who was actually the first to measure a parallax, used one. And you can tell we're coming actually to something peri-modern, you might say, because of those three, there is a surviving photograph of Bessel, not a particularly good one. Raise your hand if you know the first American president who was photographed. Take a stab. No, I didn't say during his term. I said ever photographed, period. Yes, John Quincy Adams, precisely. Bravo. Much the same time, this is in 1843, and John Quincy Adams died about the same time. Okay, so here's the growth of the refractor. Galileo, the ones that are underlined were the biggest in the world at their time. There's Galileo, and he discovered a whole bunch of stuff, not just the moons of Jupiter, but lunar libration, and the Milky Way is made of stars, and the famous, you know, mountains on the moon and phases of Venus. Huygens recognized that what Galileo had called ears were, in fact, rings of Saturn. Crosshairs and micrometers, zenith telescopes, Robert Hooke, one of the unsung heroes, I think. Newton didn't like him very much. Probably for good reason. He doesn't seem to have been a particularly likable person. But he was one of the ones who moved the telescope forward. And there is Bradley discovering aberration. Achromatic lenses. In the mid-1700s, the heliometer. Heliometer's a lens that you've made perfect, and then you cut it in half. You have to be really brave to do that. But the result is you can bring two images together and get a very accurate angle. The Fraunhofer, Struve, Dorpat, parallax, more heliometers. Yes, the Northumberland with his chalet did not discover Neptune. And then a Fraunhofer clone with which Galilei did discover Neptune. Again, a 9-inch lens. The best of them were very good. One of those is a modern photograph. Another, a drawing by Angelo Secchi from the 1850s of structure around sunspots. And the general streak structure is well produced in both. More refractors. Wow, 1847, Harvard and Volkova had the biggest telescopes in the world, biggest refractors in the world. Clark discovered the companion of Sirius with an 18.5-inch. The moons of Mars with a 26-inch. Vienna got a 27-inch, a 30-inch, a 36-inch. Ah, we're moving into Lick. 36-inch at Lick in the 1880s, with which Keeler measured radio velocities that led into the recognition by several astronomers of the rotation of the Milky Way and the general structure of the stars in the disk. The 40-inch Clark refractor at Yerkes, more radio velocities, but what that really did was spectral types, classification of stars. And then the 49-inch, which you've never heard of because it was never used. We're now going to move to reflectors. The first reflector used for astronomical purposes, I think it's funny. It says, best wishes, your friend, Izzy. Last year, the appreciation certificates we gave to the Forum on History of Physics officers as they retired were with period calligraphy done by my cousin Joyce, and a Newton signature forged from the collection of Trinity College. And if the master of Trinity College comes after me, I still outweigh him. I think I can beat him down. There is an early Newtonian telescope. There are no photographs from this period, of course. In some cases, the telescopes survive, as the Galilean ones do. In other cases, they were drawn by several people, and the drawings are quite similar, so one supposes that there is at least some truth in it. Notice that it was mounted, but it was on a portable mount. And the early reflectors were all mirrors of speculum, which is a copper-nickel alloy, which tarnishes if you even look at it. And keeping up a speculum mirror telescope, well, you had to have two mirrors and change them back and forth, maybe three, because it took longer to clean and polish than it did to get them corroded again. But the speculum monsters, from Herschel to Ross, were the telescopes first used to say things about the physical structure of astronomical objects. And in those days, they quite often described a telescope by its focal length rather than its diameter. So this is Herschel's 7 foot, but the diameter was more like 7 inches. And there is a Herschel 20 foot with which he made most of the things for which he's famous. And just so you know, he wasn't unique in doing this. There is, whose was it? Yeah, Schroeder's telescope at Lilienthal from the same period. And again, the thing swings back and forth. It has the mount, it has an alt azimuth mounting, which later became unknown as people put telescopes on equatorial mountings. And was revived for one of the hopeful monsters, as you'll meet at the end. And here is the 6 foot, the 72 inch, the Leviathan of Parsonstown, with which William Parsons, 3rd Earl of Ross, recognized spiral structure in galaxies. Not known to be galaxies then, that was another issue, but he recognized spiral structure. And here's the growth of the reflector, and we'll hit again Lick somewhere in the middle. Newton, parabolic mirrors. Messier, using the Gregorian focus, and of course discovering, well, he wanted comets, but he kept finding nebulae, poor fellow. And there is Herschel, and at that time, the 18-inch was the largest in the world, and he learned a lot from it, much of which wasn't true. He learned we were at the center of the Milky Way. The Milky Way was about 3 kiloparsecs across, and that it had a fairly sharp edge beyond which there were no stars. He changed his mind later. And there's the 40-foot. Milky Way got bigger. But the old picture still gets used. And there's Ross. And then the silvering of mirrors developed by Foucault and others. And the state of the art for silvered mirrors was then back to 10 inches again. And the 36-inch Crossley, used by wonderful name, Heber Doust Curtis, to photograph nebulae. And among other things, Curtis recognized that these were external galaxies at a time when this was not generally thought to be correct. That's also the telescope used to observe clusters of stars with which Robert Trumpler recognized the existence of absorption in the interstellar medium. So at that stage, Lick was making significant scientific contributions and has continued to do so. Lots of good stuff done with the 120-inch, dealing with quasars and such. And then the Mount Wilson 60-inch came online, a somewhat better site, it's a somewhat drier site, with another new concept. In addition to location, there came the idea of keeping families off the mountain, the monastery concept, which the people who developed it think made their telescopes more productive, that the astronomer's little kid couldn't come running in the middle of the night wanting to have a story told. I don't myself have an unbiased view on this because the monasteries for a long time were men only. The first time I observed at Mount Wilson with Donna Weistrup, we had to drive down the mountain in the dawn, dead tired, before we could have a bite to eat, a shower or a place to sleep, and back up again the next afternoon to get ready for the next night. It almost converted me to being a theorist. And the 72-inch in Victoria, briefly, the largest in the universe, well, largest in the Earth anyway, Shapley used the 60-inch to recognize we were not at the center of the galaxy. And here is somebody observing with a 60-inch around 1940. And then, of course, for a long time, the 200-inch. Well, there's the 100-inch in Mount Wilson. It looks like a telescope. Here is Hubble pretending to use the 100-inch. Even Hubble didn't actually wear a three-piece suit to observe at 3 o'clock in the morning. You also don't generally look through telescopes of that sort. And here is the further development as mirrors get larger, the 100-inch, the 200-inch. The 6-meter, which is the first modern alt-azimuth, the Keck, the 16-meter equivalent VLT, and looking ahead to the 10-meter telescope. We will skip Schmitz, I think, and look just for a moment at the hopeful monsters. These were things, a known technology carried beyond reason. What do you do to prevent chromatic aberration? Well, you have a very long focal length. There's Hevelius, 1673. There's the focal point. There's the lens up there. And that is 100 feet from end to end. Could he keep it aligned well enough to use it for anything? No. On the other hand, people came out to admire it, I believe in the daytime. Hevelius was the last person to think that you did positional astronomy best with just the quadrant or the sextant and no telescope. So there, two generations after Galileo, is Hevelius observing with his second wife, Elizabeth, with a sight line that is not a telescopic one. A very fine and elegant sextant, but two generations out of fashion. Here is Herschel's 40-foot. It was never very successful. It was impossible to keep aligned, and the mirrors kept tarnishing faster than they could replace them. But the king insisted that the 40-foot be there for his visitors to see. The last big speculum mirror was the 48-inch built for Melbourne in 1869. And it gives hope for us all, because this is the telescope that eventually became the Macho Survey. So it only took 100 years or 120 to become productive. And finally, one of my favorite hopeful monsters. This is the Russian 6-meter. And you'll notice it's a tyrannosaur flying over it. Okay, the importance of Lick. Firstly, it was the first of the observatories on a relatively dry mountain peak, which was much better than being down around Sussex or Heidelberg or Dorpat or any of these places. Secondly, it had a dedicated community of users because of its association with the University of California. And thirdly, it came on board the idea of reflectors and photography fairly early. And I think those are the three things: location, clever widgetry, and the right community of users. So this is not in any sense the talk that Joe Miller would have given, though some of what he would have said is in the abstract, which is a very good one. And I will stop at this point so that the two real speakers get their full time. At most, oh no, that makes it worse, thank you. But thanks for thinking of it. One question, or comment, or rude remark? If not, let's just turn over to...
Before then, I have a request.
Yes, sir.
Could you advertise the forum so that I will send out these things?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah, very important. Raise your hand if you're a member of the American Physical Society. Raise your hand if you're a member of the American Physical Society and not a member of the Forum on History of Physics. Sign-up sheet starts right there. Thank you for reminding me.
Please sign up and get back.
It doesn't even cost anything to belong, unless you already belong to a bunch of other forums.